You are listening to the Colorado Bowhunters Association podcast. I am your host, Jake Kunkin.
Welcome back to another episode of the CBA's ABCs of Bowhunting. I am here with bowhunter and author Bob Windauer. Bob wrote a book called Silvertip, The Life and Adventures of Paul Schaefer, Master Bowhunter and Bowyer. And I got interested in Paul Schaefer by listening to Cameron Haynes mention him on Joe Rogan's podcast, along with Bart Schlayer. I ended up looking up Paul. I found your book. I found your phone number. I gave you a call, and now I'm sitting on your porch here in Montana.
And it's a pleasure having you.
Bob, it was great meeting you. We just walked around your property. You showed me some of your animals, your photos, your workshop, and man, I want to be you when I grow up, Bob. At least that's my goal. Before we get into the story of Paul and how you met him, I'm curious about yourself. Where did you grow up? How did you find your way into hunting? How did you find your way into archery? Anywhere you'd like to start, I'm curious.
Okay, I grew up on the south side of Chicago, and my first 7 years were in the city limits, and then my family moved rural about 10 miles further south. My dad was a dentist, and I was regularly back in the city with him, and my grandparents lived in the same neighborhood, and my great-grandparents lived in the same neighborhood. They all immigrated to America around 1900. So long history, and a lot of my history was urban Chicago, and a lot of it was rural south of Chicago.
I love that. What brought you out west?
My wife had two parents that were teachers, and they summer vacationed in the West almost all the time. She loved the West and wanted to come out here. I went in the Air Force when I was finished with dental school, and the Air Force decided to put me in South Dakota at a SAC base. So I was a dentist during the Vietnam War, but in South Dakota for my full tour of duty. And I really got going on hunting a little bit while I was in college, but mostly when I got to South Dakota afterwards.
Was that first exposure through roommates, through friends? Was it rifle hunting?
My first exposure was with my dad, actually, when I was about 6 years old. He'd load me in the car, and this was post-Depression days, so a lot of the people had to take care of themselves a lot during that period of time. My dad would hunt doves, and mostly it was with a .22 rifle, and he always tried for a headshot. And now we wouldn't think of doing the things we were doing then. Most of the time, the doves were on telephone wires, and so you'd avoid the wires, aim at the head, and hopefully knock the dove down. And I'd sit in the back seat of the car, and I got to look at the doves, the freshly killed doves, and touch them, and I was very fascinated by them. And before too long, when I was 12, I had a .22 rifle of my own, and there were a lot of people, primarily it was a mixed neighborhood south side of Chicago, and well, actually ethnic neighborhoods all kind of touching each other, and a lot of the people ate a lot of sparrows and starlings during the Depression, yes. And so some of the older folks hired me for a nickel a bird they had to be headshots so that the meat wasn't disturbed.
Sure.
And they hired me for a nickel a bird to shoot blackbirds and starlings and sparrows for them. And just all I had to do was shoot it in the head, put it in the freezer, and when I had 6, 8, 10 of them, I'd bring them to them. They'd give me a nickel a bird, and I had enough to buy another box of .22 shells, and away I went again.
I love it.
So
those are some chores I would have looked forward to as a kid.
I did.
We didn't get to have that opportunity on Long Island. It was more mowing yards and raking leaves.
Uh-huh.
How cool. And so then in South Dakota University, Was it a roommate that took you out hunting or some friends?
South Dakota was the military. Period. And my dad actually started me hunting. He started me with firearms, made sure I knew all the rules, and field tested me with just about everything. We shot together a lot and hunted together some. Dad had done more bird hunting than I did. And we had a neighbor who had beagles and Brittany Spaniels. He'd bird hunt with the Brittanys, and he'd hunt rabbits, cottontail rabbits, with the beagles. And we had 6 acres of property with a lot of cottontails on it, so he hunted regularly on our property, and he'd always invite me to hunt with him.
How
so
cool.
I learned a lot of shotgunning from our friend.
It's so interesting because I came into archery first. Long Island is an archery only unit. And then moving out to Colorado, we were just discussing off mic carrying a sidearm for bears and mountain lions and things on your game when you're going to recover it. But I didn't get into archery or pistols or rifles or marksmanship until I was, I don't know, 31, 32 years old. Having a foundation in that stuff, especially as a kid, I'm assuming one gives you a level of respect for the weapons and what goes on, treating them professionally, but two, really exposes you to a lot more potential out there. I'm curious how that led to one, archery, and two, big game. What came first there?
Okay. One, archery. When I was about 6, as near as I can tell, and I think I wrote about this in the book, I'm pretty sure I did, I was at my grandmother's and grandfather's house, and they had a scary basement. There were some creaky wood steps that went down into the basement. It was usually dark down there till you lit a light. It was an exposed bulb with a string hanging down from it, and I'd get that lit when I got down halfway down the stairway. And one time going down the stairs, I happened to notice on my right-hand side between the wall studs were two bows hanging from a nail, and there was a quiver of arrows there, too. It ends up they were the two bows were Indian-style self-bows that my grandfather helped my father build when my father was in the Boy Scouts. It
Whoa.
Was for his archery merit badge. And so they built the arrows together too, and Grandpa took them down for me and showed me how to string the bows, and he took me out and I did my first shooting with my grandfather with bows that he and my dad had built together when my dad was a Boy Scout.
Wow, that is so cool.
It was so special.
It sounds it, and it's interesting because I took my girlfriend's father to the local archery shop the other day to get him all fitted out for his, we'll say, first official compound bow, you know, mm-hmm. a 2023 model. And he's so excited about it. But what I mentioned to him was, notice how many children are here, because archery, especially in the United States, there's competitive shooters and 3D shooters, but there's hunters and children
yeah.
are the people that are into archery.
Uh-huh.
And so it's just so interesting how a lot of kids, whether it's school or summer camp or gym class, that's their first kind of exposure. And some people say it was fun and that's the last time I shot a bow. And other people said, I haven't stopped since.
Uh-huh.
So if I could steer this towards, what was your first big game hunting experience?
Big game. In college, I was already trying out the bow as a hunting weapon.
Mm-hmm.
I had used it on rabbits and things like that as I was growing up as a boy. I got a couple birds with it too, probably. I can't remember exactly anymore. I'm sure I did. I was hunting for deer and not doing very well, and I had a ground blind set up, and I was hiding in the ground blind, and a red fox came by on the game trail, and I got a shot at the red fox and dead centered it. And so
wow.
I was really, really lucky. That was my first bow kill. While in college, I was not lucky enough to get a deer during that whole, I was 3 years in college. I condensed my education into 3 years rather than 4 so I could get into dental school earlier.
Wow.
And so it worked for me. It was hard work, but
I can say that's ambitious. Good job.
it was hard. And then, while in the service in South Dakota, my first hunting season there, I got my first doe, and
so cool.
It was the last weekend of the season, Thanksgiving weekend.
Was this on base or was this somewhere else?
Off base.
Yeah.
We hunted in the Black Hills, and so it was backcountry hunting.
Very cool. Mm-hmm. Wonderful. I would love to talk about your hunting history and all of the animals you just showed me, your trips to Africa. But I'm really curious in terms of how, and we're fast forwarding a lot for the folks listening, in terms of Paul Schaefer, and some of you listening may have heard of him. Some of you, this might be the first time you're hearing of him. How he came into your world. Did you know anything about him before actually interacting with him and as you detail in the book, your children starting to interact with him. Had you like heard rumblings about him? Did he have some lore to him in this area?
He had a lot of lore in this area. Paul had been an exceptional high school athlete. And he
Great
was,
Falls?
In Great Falls,
gotcha.
Correct. And he was really good at track, at football, and at wrestling. And he was a state champion his last year in high school in wrestling. He was number one in the state, if I'm not mistaken, as a running back playing football. And he played at Montana State University against University of Montana in an East-West game. There's an East-West game every year.
Mm-hmm.
Paul was the outstanding player in that game. He scored several times. I've written about it in the book. I can't give you exact details right now, but he played with serious injuries. His coach, who I interviewed, was very upset with Paul for not having told him the degree of injuries that he had. He had major injuries during that game, and enough that it cost him the next year of football. He had surgeries during that year, and shoulder rebuilt, a knee operated on, and I think an ankle also, but anyway, the shoulder was the most significant injuries, and so Paul really everybody noticed him as a football player and as a wrestler. He was exceptionally strong. He grew up a farm boy and did a lot of heavy work all the time, so he was exceptionally strong. He had two brothers that were exceptional wrestlers also, a father who had been a Golden Gloves boxer, and so it was a sport-minded family that knew how to compete and knew how to work hard, and that's what made him as great as he was. Did I know him first? No, I didn't know anything about Paul before we moved to Montana in 1972.
Mm-hmm.
Paul is 6 years younger than I am.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Paul was 6 years younger than I was. And so we were nearly the same age. But I didn't hear much about him. And then when I started to hear about him, it was usually Paul won this fight at such and such a bar, and Paul, well, he got a huge elk this year, and you know, things that a lot of times were for sure true, and other times you wonder, is it true?
Mm-hmm.
He did win three fights with four punches as a total, and in the last one, a man ended up with a broken jaw, and it wasn't Paul, and that was a costly experience for both of them. It was a sad thing, and Paul learned around that time that he ought to think more than he ought to use his hands, and so things really changed, and again, I was drifting into Paul was largely legend when I first heard about Paul.
Sure.
And again, some of the things, I just couldn't believe them. And so I just kind of ignored the existence of Paul for quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
And through Barry Wenzel, a notable bow hunter, probably most of the people that listen to this know who Barry Wenzel is. Barry and his brother Gene were notable whitetail experts, still are. Barry's boys were the same age as my kids, so they mm-hmm. were in school together. I got to know Barry, and anyway, he brought my son Dave over to Paul Schaefer's one time when he went there to visit him, and Dave was taken by Paul right away as Paul became one of his heroes. And my son Mike was passionate about whitetail deer hunting his whole life. And Mike was really the first one to make contact with Paul because Mike was trying to build a bow at that time. And he had ordered a kit from Old Master Crafters and he opened the box and got started, and he was lost immediately. And he had heard enough about Paul Schaefer that he thought, I'm going to go to Paul to get some advice. And then Paul took Mike in at that time, and Mike had to trade him a few things, and Paul helped Mike build a bow.
I love it.
Yeah. And
so the book is about 300 pages. I'm about a third of the way through it, and some of the stuff you mentioned has already resonated. Paul was helping Bob Savage build some bows for a while, or learn, how do you say it, bow making, boyering, mm-hmm. from Bob Savage, and then took his design and tweaked it a bit, and that's what turned into the Schaefer Silvertip?
Basically, yes.
And I mentioned that because you said Mike bought a kit, and he went to Paul, and from the book, slowly but surely, each component of that kit kind of got swapped out for Paul's components.
Correct.
And he ended up with the Schaefer Silvertip bow, basically for free, plus the mentorship.
Correct.
Fascinating.
And Paul ended up, a lot of his trophies, he asked Mike to mount them. Mike, from the time he was in grade school, was interested in taxidermy, and he started out with birds and fishes and went into big game little by little, and he became, he is a dentist right now. He went through dental school, but he started doing fish taxidermy and fish carving, and he won several major international shows for his carving of
wow.
fish. And he'd take them from a board to a fish and also paint everything.
It was, so he's a sculptor, he's an artist, he's more than just a taxidermist.
He truly is. And anyway, so he did a lot of taxidermy for Paul along the way. And Paul had helped him with that bow, and Mike forever felt indebted to Paul. Even after he died, he thought he hadn't done enough back to Paul for all the help Paul had given him.
Well, that leads me to a question, and we had talked about this a little bit before we started recording, but you moved to Montana in 1972. You meet Paul in the mid-80s. Paul has a tragic ski accident in 1993 and passed away, for those who aren't unaware. For a man to be in your life for 6 years, and then for you to spend, you said, almost 14 years research and writing the book, must have had a tremendous impact on you and your family, and to warrant that much dedication of your time, Bob. I'm curious what it was, and maybe this isn't a simple answer, and that's okay, but what was it about Paul that made you feel like he deserved that much of your life, of your attention, of your kids' lives?
It started with my knowing Paul's legend, or parts of Paul's legend, let's put it that way, and being suspicious of a guy who was known generally as a wild man. And my kids were spending more and more time with him, and not only my son Mike, to some degree, Dave to a great degree, and Dave's the one who learned the most, I think, from Paul in the long run. Our Vietnamese son, who we adopted, Tien, actually even lived with Paul for a number of years, a year and a half, I believe it was, back when he was roughly college age. And anyway, Paul was learning. I think Paul knew one aspect of or a few aspects of fathering from his own family, and he himself was learning fathering during the years he had my kids available to him. And I was a little concerned that might they be learning the things I don't want them to know.
Sure.
And so I thought I'd best start going over there and getting to know this Paul a little bit. And so my wife would bake cookies or make some sandwiches or something, and I'd give Paul a call. Paul, could I stop over? I got some cookies for you or something, and I'd love to help you clean up your shop, anything. I'm not much of a bow builder, but I'd love to help you by cleaning things up or sharpening tools, whatever's necessary. And anyway, so I was welcomed there, and I was watching very carefully, and I was pleased with just about everything I saw Paul do. And I think Dave made a comment, and you may have read that already, I don't know, but Paul was more rather a boss, rather than a boss to him, he was more of a father to him. He took the kids on almost as his own children and really was good with them. Discouraged fighting, encouraged picking the right girls, things like that. He was giving him a great orientation, and little by little, I felt very comfortable with Paul. At the same time, Paul was probably sizing me up too, and we ended up building a gradual friendship that became a very strong friendship with a lot of personal interaction between the two of us. And I learned a lot about hunting and bow hunting and bow building from Paul Schaefer, and I hope he learned some fathering from me. So anyway, that's
I think that's more than a fair trade. For those who haven't read the book yet, and I say yet because you're all going to go buy it and read it, and Bob's going to be busy at the UPS store. Paul had not a wife, but a girlfriend, and had a child with that woman who they then separated, and he didn't get much time with his son, whether it was due to money constraints or time constraints. But do you feel that it seems like your kids kind of stepped into that role of the son he wasn't able to spend as much time with and raise? Do you feel like that's kind of an accurate way of looking at that?
I think it is. He had that child was born in 1990, and my son Dave graduated from high school in 1990 and then was off to college. But Paul already had several years of interaction with not only Dave but our Vietnamese son Tien, mm-hmm. and our oldest son Mike, and some with my daughter, who ended up, my daughter and my wife babysat for him regularly. The biggest problem with Paul's relationship with the woman that they never did marry was custody. And the parts of Paul's reputation that could be misdirected were used by the little child's mother as ammunition in the courtroom. And Paul was humiliated repeatedly during that time. I sat through one day of the hearings, and my wife sat through the other day, and we both felt the same way. It was a brutal mistreatment of a man. And it's a shame it happened. And it's one of the reasons why I wrote the book. I wanted, Paul also had a daughter from his first marriage. Paul mm-hmm. was married three times in about that many years back when he was started out in college and then after college. And he wasn't ready yet for marriage, and a couple of the women weren't either. And I was able to talk to two of the three. And anyway, the process educated or hardened Paul, I believe, but he needed to learn. He was isolated away from the daughter who was born first, and then later on from the son too. And so it was very hard on Paul, and he actually, a few times when we talked about these things, he actually cried. This is one of the toughest guys I ever knew, mm-hmm. and he ended up, he had emotions that were right underneath the surface.
From the way you and others describe him, he seems both a stoic and a humble man, and so it's almost like this book is a way to honor that the things he wouldn't say about himself to folks.
I didn't start out wanting to do that. I wanted an honest portrayal of the man, not the legend. And so I, of all the people that I interviewed, that's one of the reasons I wanted to interview people from all stages of Paul's life. Mm. His buddy Rosie Roseland said there were about five different stages in Paul's life.
Yeah.
And Rosie felt that people knew, he knew Paul in about really two stages, maybe three, Rosie did, and most people only knew one stage of Paul, maybe two, and didn't know the whole Paul. I got to know the most mature Paul, and unfortunately that's when he died, but at that time I just wanted his children to have an honest picture of the true man, not have legends. A lot of people who might have chosen to write that book would have, the way I feel, and it's because of the stories they tell, would have been more laboring through the legend rather than the truth. And
yeah.
So I needed the truth. And so I found it not only by knowing Paul better, but also talking to people who knew him at every stage of his life.
I love that. To relate, my grandmother passed away about a month ago. She was 103 years old.
Oh, my
She
goodness.
Lived a full life. Man. We had a celebration of her life, and the grandkids spoke, and the children spoke, and some neighbors spoke, and some friends spoke. And you get to realize that everybody had an individual relationship with this person, mm-hmm. and that what their experience and their takeaway from their time with this person was unique. And I love that you were able to capture that and portray, I don't think you've colored him in a specific way, but portray the truth about the effect he had on folks and the long-lasting impact, right? We're talking about 30 years ago, nearly, this gentleman passed away.
Yes.
And I just found out about it, and I'm fascinated by him. I'm from Colorado up here in Montana talking to you about him. So for those listening, we're not going to get through all of the amazing parts of this book, but there's a few standout items, not only in this book, but in the history of Paul that are fascinating to me. There's a gentleman named Bart Schleyer that I believe Paul was a mentor to him to a certain degree. I'm curious if you remember or recall it all. How did they first come to interact? Do you know how they met?
I can't tell you exactly. I've not tried to learn that. But Bart was a wildlife biologist, and he was, 6 years younger than Paul.
Mm-hmm.
And so Bart, I think Bart probably looked up Paul. Paul was already building a reputation at that time. And Bart was, in his own way, a truly exceptional man and an exceptional outdoorsman, exceptional bow hunter, a traditionalist. He and Paul had a lot of things in common. And I think Bart looked up Paul. If I'm remembering, Brad, I did 2 days of interviews with Brad Adams, and Brad admired Paul the most. He was a very close friend of Bart's, and Bart's a close second as far as overall impact on him as a human being and as a hunter. And so he thought a lot of both of them. And Bart was just incredible in so many ways, and there was a wild part of his spirit too. He was much more domesticated than Paul, but really also wild. And Bart, like every night in hunting camp, no matter how exhausting the day was, he would find a log that he could lift. He'd do his weightlifting with generally an item from the forest, a rock or a log, sit-ups, push-ups, things like that before he went to bed every night. He was just immensely strong and very competent. He worked with the most dangerous animals, usually bears and lions, not just the mountain lion, but tigers, Siberian tigers. And he also did some work with snow leopards as time went on, and just extremely competent in with the dangerous animals in the outdoors. And he ultimately got killed by one, unfortunately.
Yeah. So I've been doing a bunch of research on these two gentlemen, and Bart went to MSU, and then he became a wildlife biologist. He was hired by Montana to trap and track grizzlies.
Mm-hmm.
And then the thing that's interesting to me and stood out to me in one of your chapters is called Kodiak, and Paul and Bart and Brad and Jeff went up to Alaska. And on that, I forget who it was, but they're asking Paul about his time in Africa. And he was talking about a time where twice where his professional hunter got attacked by a lioness. And in one of those instances, and I'm giving away a little bit of the good stuff in the book, Paul shot an arrow at a lion that was attacking this professional hunter and saved his life, basically.
Yes.
While that would terrify most people, it seems like this is intriguing to Bart and maybe possibly a part of the inspiration for him to want to go pursue not only hunting in Africa, but he ended up getting hired to go track tigers in Siberia. Mm-hmm. And it just seems so fascinating to me that you hear a story about a guy getting attacked by lions and that's driving you towards the fire versus away from it.
Yep.
Oh, man. You could see that this guy just had an impact, whether it was through his passion or his charisma, on other folks in terms of, I want to see what you're seeing. I want to experience the world that you seem to get to experience. It's endlessly fascinating to me. There's one thing you wrote in here that I couldn't wrap my head around fully, and maybe you'll be able to explain it further. In terms of Brad Adams, you write that he was the lone survivor of four Kodiak hunts, meaning out of those three gentlemen, he's the only one still living?
Yeah, four Kodiak hunters.
Oh, four Kodiak hunters. I gotcha. So Paul passed away, Bart passed away, and Jeff passed away.
Correct.
Gotcha. I didn't fully understand what
Jeff
that meant.
Jeff was second, and Paul first, Jeff second, and then Bart next.
Gotcha.
And Brad, Brad hunts alone. He still hunts alone, and he's been in multiple plane wrecks over the years. He flies both fixed wing and helicopters, bringing skiers and mountain climbers onto McKinley, now it's Denali.
Right.
Bart, he's just special. He went out of his way to be interviewed. He would be driving by here on the interstate down at Missoula, and we're roughly 150 miles, roughly, from where he'd have been passing down below us. And he came up here twice, stayed overnight with me, and interviewed late into the night and then a good bit of the next day before he went on with his visiting his family for Christmas each time he did that.
That is so cool.
Amazing guy. I want to interrupt you for a second.
Sure.
Probably the thing that was most mentioned by the people I interviewed about Paul Schaefer was his friendship. One of them said it best, and he said, I believe it was Ron Bain, and he said that once Paul became your friend, it was like you had a brand on your forehead that only Paul could recognize, and you were always his friend. He'd almost die for you if for any reason at all. He was your friend, period. And Paul would do special things for people that were in trouble a lot of times financially or whatever, injured somehow. He might cut a load of firewood, have a pickup just mounded with firewood and bring it to you for your stove or bring you a half an elk, things like that, for meat. It just he'd find a way of fulfilling your needs as a friend, and he would do that.
Incredible. It's interesting what people, let me correct my mic, it's interesting what people come to value in their lives, because both Paul and Bart didn't seem to value money all that much.
Didn't bother them at all.
Whereas for me, it's such a stressor, not that money is a stressor, but security is a stressor. Paying your bills, paying your insurance, having gas in the tank, being able to fund the adventures. It's interesting that, and maybe they would say something different if they were here, but that wasn't a deterrent to them. They would still find a way to build a bow, go on the adventure, go on the hunt, provide something to somebody in need when they didn't have much.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a different breed of person.
Yeah, and I think, I don't think that led to the death of Paul, but I'm about positive that led to the death of Bart. They were so competent that they were too relaxed, I believe, with danger. And danger did not matter to them, and just like money didn't matter to them. They would find a way, no matter what it was, they'd find a way and they'd make this or that happen. And, like Bart going out alone, moose hunting, where he was, it's up near Whitehorse in the Yukon Territory, and anyway, leave your pepper spray in your tent when you go. Just eat supper, get out there with your bow, and do your thing. And so he had no firearm to protect himself, and he had no pepper spray to protect himself. And it's Brad's feeling that his calling of a moose, working with moose calls, attracted a grizzly bear. And mm-hmm. he said the grizzly bear probably snuck in, and once they're focused on a kill, it doesn't matter what they're going to kill. He said they'll come in and the attack happens. Bart, his bow was still leaning against a tree. His pack was right there undisturbed. And the bear came for him and did him in right there. And he never had a chance to protect himself. So.
Oh, man. I've listened to stories of bear attacks from a few different people in the podcasting space. Meat Eater had one. A few other folks had one. And it just... it feels like, in theory, you might be able to prepare for it, but in the heat of the moment, it is all reaction and probably a little bit of hope. That fearlessness, for me, I've really had to build up a tolerance of fearlessness. I am from Long Island, New York. There is no wilderness out there. There's no predators. And so to be a person who spends multiple nights in the backcountry, it took me a little ways to build that up. And I think some people just, they could skip that step, maybe. Mm-hmm. Or maybe it's just not allowing the thoughts to come in, not allowing it to take over your mind. Because even in Colorado, sleeping in a tent, you start hearing some coyotes go off and your mind starts to wonder. You know a grizzly bear is not coming. Most likely a mountain lion's not coming. But just that idea is that we can psych ourselves out so much. Mm-hmm. It's so interesting that these guys just, I guess, didn't have that piece of the puzzle.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if, you have a city background, I have a city background, and a dangerous human is a different creature completely. We're dealing, most of the time in city life, we're dealing with dangerous creatures who are equipped like we are, and very similar to how we are, only they have a focus on doing you evil most of the time. And if they can do it with you not expecting it, they're better off, which is what they're doing. And I think we develop this, we can call it fear if we want to. It's not fear. It's a wise caution, I think, that we'll develop and try to protect ourselves by being a little more aware than you might be if you're in a safe setting all the time. Cities are not, they're not always safe places. And I think that's part of it. Something else that's interesting, I went to a lecture by a biologist who was doing exactly what Bart Schlayer did. They would find denning bears, and they would tranquilize them, take them out of their den, do a biological study on them, tuck them back in, and let them start coming to, but tuck them back in safely, and away they go. And anyway, they did a study with MSU athletes, male athletes that weighed the same weight as the bear did. And so they take muscle biopsies from the bear, muscle biopsies from the athletes, and measure the contractile strength of the muscles with electrical stimulation.
Fascinating.
And the bears were, this is rusty knowledge, but it's going to be very close to 100% right, around 7 to 9% stronger. Their muscles contracted with 7 to 9% more strength than a human-trained athlete of the same weight. And so if you think about a Kodiak bear, a grizzly bear that might weigh 500 or 600 pounds, that's two or three super strong trained football players, let's say, from a college team. So you're dealing with something that is used to killing. That's its job, or it wouldn't be able to stay alive. So it's used to killing. It's used to stealth. It's used to surprise. And it is immensely stronger than its prey, no matter what its prey is, almost all the time. And so, a bear is a powerful thing, and you can understand why they can do the damage they do in almost no time at all.
Absolutely. I think a lot of this, how we got to having this conversation sitting in your porch, was because recently Braylon Shockey and Cameron Haynes released a grizzly bear video. Braylon Shockey is Jim Shockey's son, and he took much more to videography than he did to hunting. And he is producing some beautiful hunting films now. And Cameron Haynes was invited to go to Alaska with Kip Fulks, who founded Under Armour. And it was the first time he had returned to Alaska since his friend Roy Roth passed away. Roy and Bart worked in the same taxidermy studio in Alaska. And so this is how it all kind of came full circle. I watched this grizzly bear video. One, I have no desire to hunt a grizzly bear, at least not right now. But Cam was frustrated that their guide had Cam shot. I'm ruining it for a few folks, but go watch the video. Cam shot a grizzly and didn't put that perfect shot on him. Grizzly went into some alders, and you don't know what other bears are back there. So they're all in there, kind of peak height, heightened awareness, making some noise, trying to find this bear. And Cam's trying to get a shot on it through the alders and doesn't have a clean shot. The bear starts charging, and the guide shoots the bear. And this was 2 years ago, and Cam was a little conflicted about releasing the video due to the purity of the hunt. And, you know, his saying was, if it was my time to go, it was my time to go. And it's just like, that is not how most people think, right? It's not, I'm on equal footing with this thing, with doing some rough calculations. That's most likely 30 times stronger than what you are. But people have that little mentality. And I think Cam, maybe it's not a dying breed, but he's one of those holdovers from that previous generation of just pure toughness, maybe no fear of danger, and just wanting to get that out there and be after it. But it really is interesting to me how this gentleman, Cam, who is one of the most popular bow hunters in the country, if not the world right now, really looked up to Paul and Bart and wanted to be like those guys. And those guys, as rough and tumble as they may be or have been, or the lore around them is, they were also very gentle people that cared about the people that cared about them, that took people under their wing, that taught people. And so it's just so interesting, that juxtaposition between, I want to go hunt a grizzly bear, and if he kills me, he kills me. And also, let me go be a second father to these children and teach them things that I wish were taught to me. It's just so interesting how the dualities can exist in a human being. You know, you'd think some guy that's going to kill grizzly bears is a psychopath, you know, chest beaten type of human being, but there's a gentleness there.
Yeah.
Fascinating. Pivoting a little bit, there's a quote from the book that I really like, and it's resonated with me lately as I'm getting my girlfriend's father set up with archery equipment. I think this is your quote. It says, with time, each of us became frustrated with the recurring needs for new gadgets to improve the performance of our mechanical bows. And I was wasting money while funding the process. And so it seems like that was kind of an impetus in terms of you and your family and your children steering towards that traditional bow lifestyle. And for those who don't know, Dave really came under the wings of Paul and is now carrying on Schaefer Silvertip bows and the legacy of all that. Does he do that by himself? Does he have anybody helping him out with that?
He has, on occasion. He's hired, generally it's a high school kid who's really good in shop and worked with them. But Dave's been, for the last probably at least 6 years, doing it all himself. His wife takes care of the orders, phone contacts, mailings, things like that. She's extremely knowledgeable about the different woods and things just from her experiences over the years. They've been at it a long time. And so, you know, she gives him a lot of help, but Dave does all the work himself.
And I apologize for my lack of knowledge here. Is he making both takedown recurves and one-piece bows?
Yes, and longbows.
And longbows. Mm-hmm. Fascinating. I was telling you off mic, I have a few animals to get through in the Colorado Big 8 before I try again with traditional equipment. But funny enough, or just ironically enough, the podcast equipment we're using now comes from a gentleman named South Cox. South Cox is a boyer in Colorado. He puts out some magnificent films. He's a great mule deer hunter. But you could see the time and effort and passion that goes into figuring out the riser and the lamination and the strings and the arrows and all of that stuff. And so it feels like a little bit of kindred spirits to me, where I'm using this gentleman's equipment to talk to you about the other guy, the Montana version, maybe a little bit more extreme, but the Montana version of that same story. So cool, man. Let me see what else I got here. And if there's anything in general that you just want to share about Paul or about your journey writing this book, about getting, you know, taking a look at this man's life for so many years through so many eyes, I'm curious if there's anything in general that you just want to share about him or your story or the process. And if nothing jumps out, that's okay as well.
I guess one thing I'd love to share, I look at myself, I've been able to kill a few animals with bow and arrow, and more with a rifle over the years, and a fair number with the shotgun, as birds and things like that. I think the hunter, by virtue of the process, especially after you hunt for a while, you become familiar with how much the animal wants to live. Their business is staying alive, and they go through stuff we cannot imagine in the wintertime and on these hot summer days, lack of water, things like that, and raising their young through the most difficult conditions with other predators out there trying to get them all the time. If we think about elk or deer or sheep or whatever, the prey animals, traditionally prey animals, but we understand, and I think I'm learning, I'm 81 years old right now, I'm learning how much I value life itself, and not just for myself, but life itself, the all that's living around us. If we look around, there, you know, every blade of grass, every leaf on the trees, every fiber of the animals that we like to hunt and things like that, I think we learn to appreciate things differently than the person who doesn't do that. They can't, because they don't have the experience. It's why every one of us is different, and why hunters are different from non-hunters. I think
that I agree with you there. There's a phrase often used by a gentleman named Clay Newcomb, who works with Meat Eater, and he says, living life close to the land. Mm-hmm. And that's something, both of us being city boys, that we had to choose to have exposure to. And it is really powerful once that light turns on. It's you don't want it to dim. You don't want to turn it off. We all have places in life where our obligations require stuff of us. But just to kind of resonate with what you're saying, I remember the first white-tailed deer I shot. I got shot a doe in 2017. I learned how to shoot a bow on the internet, and I bought one from my local shop, and I found a public land spot, and I made it happen after, you know, had to track this thing. But when I was gutting it and I was feeling the warmth of that animal and taking the heart out of the animal, there was a sadness there, but there was also a recognition of this mammal is made of the same parts I am, is about the same weight as I am. Its life was ended pretty close to instantly, and it just brings the value of life much higher in my own world. And you're right, the survival instincts of any animal are 24/7, 365, nonstop, winter, summer, every season. And so I live in Boulder, Colorado. There's a hill near our house. I go hike the mountain. I see 10, 20, 30 mule deer doe on there. And I just think, you are out here day in and day out. You live here. You're surviving in the coldest of cold, the hottest of hot, days with no water. And all you have to do is survive. That is your goal, is to survive and make it into the next generation. Pivoting a little bit, northwestern Colorado, as well as Utah and southwestern Wyoming, had a really hard winter this year. And so they reduced tag allocation by about 90% in most units in northwestern Colorado. That's where I got both elk last year, two different units. And I went out there to drive through some, and man, they're not joking. I saw half dozen mule deer stuck in barbed wire fences, still, you know, skin on, just emaciated. Mm-hmm. I found four cow elk in a culvert in a ditch that obviously they had just gotten stuck in, too weak to get out of. And as you alluded to, they are going through the rut, and then they're immediately in survival mode during the winter. And then they have to birth something in, you know, March, April, May, and hope that there's enough melt for green to come up and grass to eat. And we're out there saying, I can't wait for the 1 week I'm allowed to go out there and participate, you know, drive my nice Toyota out there with my rooftop tent, my AC. And Even getting to the hunting grounds where I hunt, I access through mining land. And it's like, I'm glad these people came here to mine it because this road wouldn't exist and I wouldn't be able to get back here.
Here it's logging.
And so it's that same feeling of, I really want to participate in this, and I love participating in it, but I have an awareness of how much help I have along the way, whether it's the gas in my truck, the nice shoes on my feet, my down sleeping bag. It is just so different than the life that Paul and Bart and a lot of these gentlemen have lived. There was an article in Outdoor Life magazine, I believe it was in 2008, called The Last Wild Man. Mm-hmm. And it was about Bart Schleyer and his life and a lot of some of the items you shared with us today. But that idea, and I think that I'm borrowing from the article here, is I think about how many nights these guys spent alone trying to get a match to light in the backcountry, freezing cold, just hoping for that sun to rise again. And for most people, it's saying, all right, I did that once. I'm good.
Yeah.
And they just lived for it. They couldn't get enough. I think I'm right in those middle grounds. You know, I like a warm, clean bed, and I also like those experiences which test your limit a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And beyond your limit, test your character a little bit. I was telling my girlfriend a big reason why I do this, not only the podcast, but the hunting, but also a little bit of social media. Honestly, I'm not big on the social media, is it keeps me accountable. I hunt by myself. Mm-hmm. And if I'm talking about these stories, I think it was Aldo Leopold who said, ethics is doing the right thing even when the wrong thing is legal and nobody's watching. And so this, to me, is kind of adds that somebody's watching. I won't go trespass and kill an animal and then come on here and say, I did it on public land all by myself, no issues. But there's just something that I feel like these gentlemen from this era, I don't even want to call it a toughness, a courage, a something that is missing from our modern world, that connectivity to nature. I'm not going anywhere with this. It's just I'm kind of reflecting to you at the moment.
I think that's important to think about those things, and it's a demonstration of your own values, and I admire you for that. That's really good.
I appreciate it. I think I'm still determining what those values are. I try to live a good life. I try to live an ethical life, but the more I interact with these things, the more of these situations I put myself in, the more I have to ask myself that question. And then make a choice and then live with that choice. And it's that last part where I'm still figuring it out, but I feel pretty good about being here and doing it all. And it brings me to places like this, talking to gentlemen like you, which I just absolutely love. I have no hunting mentors in my family. I picked this up out of curiosity. And like you said to me before we were on the mic, that all of your kids are better hunters than you are. Mm-hmm. That's a dream of mine, right? I don't even have children one day. But to go from a person whose family didn't hunt to becoming the hunter to becoming the teacher is an exciting potential next step, I think.
Yeah, and you're hitting on something that was one thing you said, is there anything I wanted to mention? It's a responsibility every one of us have. The values you're talking about right now, a lot of children will never get them unless they have a mentor. And the best mentor should be their father. And if we choose to have children, you know, you look at both Bart and Paul, they had sons who really needed dads like them, and they both died before they could really have an influence on those kids. And so those children lost immeasurably. That's one of the reasons I wanted to write my book for Paul's son and his daughter. And kids need parents, and they need a man they can admire. And everything we do is noticed. It's noticed, if not by your own child, it's noticed by other children or other adults. And when we do something that it contributes strength to this immeasurable influence realm that we have, we're doing a good thing. And whenever we do something that doesn't add to that, we're doing a bad thing. And we're creating maybe monsters along the way.
It's interesting to talk to you about it and hear it come out of you, because it sounds so much more certain than I can put it. I am a new hunter. I'm an adult onset hunter. Heck, I just became a man the other day. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm still learning about manhood.
Well, you haven't had hunting mentoring, for one thing. You know, I shouldn't say that because I don't really know, but you said there's no hunters in your family. Yeah, so you're learning on your own, and fortunately, you're learning from some exceptional people, and so you're apt to learn the good thing. I taught bow hunter education for 20 years, and one statement that was made several times by the more experienced fish and game people that kind of coached us a little bit was that we have a couple weeks of three nights a week, two nights a week of educating a group of children and adults on what the best things they can do once they get out and go hunting. And then they go home, and Uncle So-and-so takes them out, and he's drinking beer the whole time. He's, you know,
littering as
driving
he goes
to where they're going,
yeah.
and shooting from the vehicle on. And so, you know, they were relatively depressed that, you know, our influence is so small compared to the influence of what they're going to be exposed to out there. And you hope that they are being exposed to the right kinds of things, or they'll learn the wrong kinds of things.
Yeah, it's interesting. And to allow someone to make the choice, I think, is the trickiest part. I was talking with, again, my girlfriend's father just about leadership, and you have to learn to delegate, and you have to let people make mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, especially in the world of hunting, especially in the world of killing, that's a scary prospect, right? Can I back off enough to let this person see what is the right and wrong thing to do?
Mm-hmm.
You know, one thing that gets me a lot every year and controversial is wounding animals.
Mm-hmm.
Something we don't love to talk about with archery, but it absolutely happens.
It happens. Period.
Fortunately, I believe the wildlife biologists kind of calculate for that to a certain degree. My personal belief at this time is if you draw a tag and you draw blood, you punch your tag. If you found that animal, good for you. If you didn't find that animal, that doesn't give you the right to shoot another animal.
Mm-hmm.
Now, more than half the guys listening will say, Jake, you know what you're talking about. You're some Yankee from New York.
Yeah, yeah.
Just learn about this. It took me 10 years to draw that tag. I'm not giving this up.
Mm-hmm.
And again, these are things I haven't had to interface with yet.
Yeah.
You know, I'm fortunate. I've lost one doe. I've lost one turkey. I lost one quail, one grouse.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm hoping that's it.
Yeah.
I bet it won't be, but I'm hoping that's it.
Yeah. There's so many, you know, again, back to the killing side of things, our prey wants to live as much as we want to get that prey,
yes.
Whatever it might be. And so they're doing all they can to live. And the speed of an arrow is not the speed of sound. Most, even out of the best compound bows, you're
right.
Still slower than the speed of sound. And you have an animal that is really reactive, and so they hear that sound and they're reacting already before the arrow is there.
Yeah.
And so the chances of things going wrong are high, and so we have to, by our experience, we learn to minimize the opportunities for things to go wrong. And that's what makes, I think, the good hunter in the long run, that you're able to minimize the bad effects of what we're doing.
And I think even just that possibility is what makes people uncomfortable. As hunters, we know that it is our job to take the best ethical shot that we possibly can. But we know that nothing is guaranteed and life isn't perfect. And I can hear the echoes of some of the antis saying, well, why wound any animal? Why would you ever do any of this? Why not just go to the butcher or go to the grocery mm-hmm. store? But there's something to be said for having a bit of control over the situation, whether that is your control of yourself, whether you execute a shot well or not, choosing the animal and the type and the size and the location of the animal you want to take, but also that recognition that life is precious, I think, is really the big takeaway for me in talking to you here. Not that I didn't agree with it beforehand, but it really, you're the hunter or the hunted. When you're in that situation, you are making a choice. You know, I don't want to say you're playing God, but you're playing in God's playground, and, mm-hmm. and you're making some serious choices about what gets to keep going and what doesn't get to keep going. Chopping down a tree is a little bit different than taking down a doe or a buck or an elk or whatever it might be. But just that reverence for it, I think you're right, comes through the experiences of hunting. Mm-hmm. Changes the appreciation for life for sure.
Definitely. And I don't know what makes a hunter have to be a hunter. But there's an inner force that's there, and I feel sorry for the people who have lost that, because they'll never learn to appreciate life at the same level that the hunter will.
I don't know who I heard say it. It might have been Stephen Ranella, but he said there's people who want to go elk hunting and there's people who want to be elk hunters, mm-hmm. you know, and one is kind of a weekend experience. Maybe you got one, maybe you didn't. You go out with your buddies. And the other is kind of a lifestyle choice. Mm-hmm. And it's not just elk, any game that you're pursuing.
You're right. Mm-hmm.
Man, it's a driving force in life. I'm full of excitement here just sitting and talking to you.
Oh, thank you.
It's been about an hour since we started chatting, and it feels like 2 minutes. I want to push everyone towards checking out this book. It's called Silvertip by Robert Windauer.
Thank you.
There's a few locations you could get it, but, what is your preferred method?
Right now I really, with self-publishing, I talked to you about family time. I treasure my family time. And so I tried to not get overly involved in advertising this. So it's not advertised as it should be, but through the Schaefer Silvertip website, they can find out my, way to contact me.
Mm-hmm.
A check for $29 and mail it to me with your address and who you want it signed to, and I'm happy to sign a book and mail it. And then the footed shaft is a traditional, I don't know, they may have more than that. I'm just getting to know the people. They really want to sell my book, and so I've just given them their second box of books. They'll pay me back.
Where are they based out of?
They're Tustin, Montana.
Gotcha. Very cool. And in addition, say it to me again, Schaefer Silvertip.
Custom bows.
You guys can go check out the bows themselves traditional bow hunters as well. Please check out the equipment there. And I don't know how long it takes to build one, but you might as well get your order in.
Dave will manage about 2 bows a week is about what
Whoa.
He averages. Yeah,
that's a pretty good production rate for a one-man operation.
Yeah, but he's there's about a year wait right now. And he's kept busy all the time, but working by himself, he can get on the average about 2 per week.
That's fascinating. Well, it's definitely a road I want to travel down for sure. Bob, I really appreciate your time. Before I sign us off, is there anything else you'd like to promote, let people be aware of, even just a message to the people? And it's okay if there's not one.
I worry about the children, and we have to really look seriously at the things we face right now, and applying what we know to what's happening in the world around us. I think it's so important to have a really good influence on children, and if we're going to father a child, if we're a male, if we're going to birth a child, if we're a female, I got to think about the girls. There's a lot of girls out there hunting now too. And then there's a huge responsibility that we have from then on. And even after they're an adult, you're still a parent. And so take care of that responsibility as well as being a good hunter. I think that's really important.
I think that's a wonderful message. For those of you who are listening who are not currently a member of the Colorado Bow Hunters Association, for $40 a year, you become a member of this 501c3 organization protecting hunting and archery rights in Colorado since 1969. If you're out of state, you can still join the CBA. And being that we're in Montana, check out the Montana Bowhunters Association. I'm sure they're a strong organization up here as well.
Same.
Very cool. Bob, I can't thank you enough, man. This has been wonderful.
Yeah, thank you very much.
I appreciate it. See you, everybody.